Even though many of you know it, my name is Ted Peters and I teach at Pacific Lutheran Seminary. And the title of this session is Satanism and Society, or Satanism and Today. But it's really a continuation of a discussion that we began at 4 o'clock this afternoon on sin. And just to remind you, I had talked about how it is that I got involved in this particular subject, even though I felt that I needed to research the concept of Satanism. I wanted to do it within the context of looking at the Christian understanding of sin, and then in the process of pursuing that, have been trying to develop what I consider the structure of how sin and evil work, and suggested there were seven steps from innocence, anxiety, down to radical evil in blasphemy. And I think before I start talking about what you see on this blue outline here, the Satanism phenomenon, I would like to finish my remarks about blasphemy, and you'll see then why it is that, or where it is that I put Satanism as a phenomenon in this particular category. Let me just double check, does everybody have access to a blue one? There probably are not enough of them. If you could, there goes the last one. I need one to look at myself. So maybe those in the back row could share up a little bit, and then the ends, people sitting on the ends would have access to one. But we're not going to look at the blue outline for a moment. That's blasphemy. Did I spell it right? I didn't. PH. I want to make one theological point and tell you why it is that I'm thinking the way I am, both about satanic cults and trying to ask myself, what does blasphemy mean, and why is it that I think it to be the worst dimension of sin, the what I would call radical evil. And I guess my first contact with the idea of blasphemy came from my mother, who tried to get me to stop swearing as a kid. The proverbial hitting my thumb with a hammer and breaking the second commandment and using God's name in vain, that was blasphemy, she told me, and I tried very diligently not to do that. She said, when something like that happens, say fiddlesticks. And I worked on fiddlesticks for some time, but you know, it just didn't just didn't have the power that good old blasphemy had. Well, in doing this research on sin and evil, I ran into another phenomenon that's caused me to think again about how the word blasphemy might describe a certain form of evil that I consider particularly heinous. And as I had said earlier this afternoon, we ran this seminar in Berkeley on sin and evil, and we brought some people in to interview, and I spent some time both outside the seminar and inside the seminar with a woman named Jamie. Now, I'm going to tell you Jamie's story, and let me tell you right now that this is not a pretty story. This is a bad story, and if you don't like it and if you want to leave, that's okay. Jamie was about 12 years old, and she was going to school, and she was kidnapped. Some men stopped their car, and they put a burlap bag over her, threw her in the back seat of the car, and tied her up, and carried her to a still unknown location. And when the burlap bag was pulled off, she found herself in a house that was under construction, and there were two other girls about her age, 12 years old. She didn't recognize them. She didn't know whether they were from her school or some other school. The girls were stripped naked, and then they were interrogated by three men whom she described as Nazi-looking, in their mid-20s, white, hair closely cropped, and that must have been her image of what evil people do. And they asked the girls, "Why are you here?" Well, of course, they didn't know why they were there. "You're here to you're here to feed off love. You know what that means? Well, no, they didn't know what that meant. Well, then began a number of hours of persuasion, you might say, in which these girls were supposed to come up with the correct answers to the questions they asked. Jamie was taken into a separate room. Each of the men took him into a separate room. She was tied up with her hands against the pillar in this house under construction. And one of the men began to run a large knife, the point of the knife, up and down the interior of her legs, very, very slowly. And he would ask her questions, and he would try to get her answers. If the answer was a correct one, the knife would keep moving. If it was a false answer, the knife would stop. That filled her with terror, because she didn't know then what would come next. I'll spare you a number of the details, but there was a good deal of pain inflicted, and her anxiety level was as high as it possibly could be. But she described herself as learning very fast, and the question was, what is love? What does it really mean to love somebody? And what does it mean to feed off love? These were the kinds of questions that this man asked. From time to time, the girls would be brought together and separated. Now, what I think is going on here as a method of torture is to get complicity on Jamie's part, because now she hears herself saying what they want her to say. Or the blasphemy of it is that they're capturing her soul, is what they're doing. This is not just physical torture, this is an emotional capture of some kind. Now, late in the day, then all three girls, oh yes, and while she's doing this, she can hear one of the other two girls screaming constantly or repeatedly in one of the other rooms. Late in the day, they're all brought up, and there's a table prepared then in the living room, and the girl who had been screaming is laid out on this table. And now again, through the question-answer method, Jamie knows what she has to do. And she plunges the dagger into the chest of the girl on the table and kills that girl. The men then cut out the dead girl's heart while it's still beating, cut it up into three pieces, and eat it. Jamie now knows what it means to feed off love. And she's taken back to her spot. And on the way that she's taking back, she sees the men cutting up the body of the dead girl and putting the pieces in these in garbage bags. While the men were preoccupied, Jamie escapes. And she felt that had she not escaped, that she herself eventually also would have become a victim of ritual sacrifice. just as an interesting sidelight, I asked her, how did you escape? big question. And she said, well, once she was tied up again, she says a great presence came over her, and a confidence that if she stayed, she was going to die, but she was going to get out. And she regained all of her self-confidence and all of her wits. And one of the men had left the dagger in the room, and she was able to inch around, kick it towards herself, cut the ropes, and leave through a window without them knowing it. Just as a sidelight, I might also mention, as I told you about Farisani's torture earlier this afternoon, and the gruesome cruelty that he had endured in the South African prison, he also said something very similar. When I asked him, well, tell me about your faith and your courage, he says, well, God visited him and gave him visions of the future, which meant that he was able to sustain all of that cruelty with holding his character intact, interestingly enough. I asked Jamie, I said, were you talking about an angel? Oh, no, I don't know what it was, she says. I don't know what it was. She was Jewish at the time, as a little girl. She's now Christian. She's joined an Episcopal church. And just as another footnote, when the priest in the Eucharist says, "This is my body, take and eat," she has a catharsis of sorts. And one of the major pastoral issues has been for her to work through that. Now, why blasphemy? What I think is going on here, never having talked to her abductors to ask them why they behaved the way they did, what they did for Jamie's concept of love was to so taint it that for years after, she was unable to hear the word love, to think of herself loving in a way that was at all emotionally healthy. I mean, love was associated with ritual death for Jamie. And they didn't just tell her, right? They got her to think and to act the way they wanted to. She was a participant. She was not an observer. Now, love is a very important Christian word. It's a very important general word. But what would happen then if you take Christian words, Christian symbols? In the other case that I just mentioned briefly, in the book Suffer the Child, written by Judith Spencer, is about a little girl whose pseudonym is Jenny, who grows up in a satanic cult and has experiences very similar to Jamie, even at the age of 5 years old, of her skin being cut from her body and eaten by the Satan worshippers, her blood being drained from her body and drunk. And the title of the book, Suffer the Child, comes from one of the lines of the priest in the cult, who quotes Jesus, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for theirs is the kingdom of God." But in this case, it's, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for theirs is the kingdom of hell." The liturgy throughout in this group was a deliberate prostitution of the Christian symbols. The Lord's Prayer said backwards, the devil is Lord, Christ is not Lord, the devil is Lord, Christ is put in the position of being the opposite of what he is. And so that's the symbol system then with which this little girl grows up. I call this blasphemy because one of the most precious things that you and I have with regard to our relationship to God are the symbols through which we think about it. God is love, God forgives me, whatever that body of symbols is, so that in great time of peril, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, as Psalm 23 says, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. There is a sense in which no matter how terrible life gets for us, we can go into our consciousness and the symbols remind us that we have a gracious God. What's being done deliberately, both in the case of Jamie and the case of Jenny, is that someone is trying to rob them of the very symbols that could give them in their own private consciousness that comfort and strength. And when you think of using the Lord's name in vain, I can't think of a way in which that could be done in a worse fashion. So that's why I refer to blasphemy as radical evil, because 99% of the sin that you and I engage in, or that you and I are victims of, is sin that's done in the name of what is good. That is to say, the symbols are intact. If you and I commit murder, or if we rob, or whatever it is, we're going to justify it in the name of something that is good. Radical evil has that slight difference. It's a deliberate attempt to prostitute the good in behalf of the evil. Well, that's all I want to say theologically, and my agenda now is to turn and try to take a look at Satanism as a phenomenon. What I don't want to talk about is Satan. I just haven't had time to get around thinking about that. I did mention that the book, The Satan Syndrome, by Nigel Wright, is one that I've recommended for a bookstore here. It's the best of the evangelical books in this line that I've run into. It's a very conscientious look at the relationship between sinfulness in our lives and our understanding of Satan. So I recommend that. But I'd like to turn now and take a look at Satanism as a social phenomenon. But we've gone through a lot of heavy stuff this afternoon and to open this one, and I don't feel compelled to finish my agenda. So let me just ask, if the basis of what we've said so far, you have any thoughts that you want to register? Yes, ma'am.
Might be a little off, but I was just struck by you saying that Tarazona in prison said he had visions of the future. Is that right?
Not the big future of events that would happen a day or two in advance.
Right, okay.
They could be confirmed so that he was sure he wasn't going crazy, that God was present in a way that he knew he wasn't alone in this prison setting.
Right.
But Farisani also could rely upon the symbols. He said he knew large swaths of the Bible. Oh no, he said at first he had a Bible in prison. And he had these long hours with nothing to do. He read his Bible. Day after day he read his Bible. Well, eventually he committed a lot of it to memory. And the guard saw him reading his Bible and enjoying it. So they took his Bible away from him, see. Well, by this time he'd memorized large swaths of it, so he would just recite it to himself. And so what he had in his own private consciousness, he had a safety zone. He had an oasis there. And so fortunately the guards in the South African prison weren't Satanists. They might have figured out a way to make him feel worse. Well, should I turn to the phenomenon of Satanism itself then? Well, I felt that it behooved me to look into the matter of Satanism, just to ask what is it, in part because, as I said before, people somehow or other thought that because I knew something about the New Age, I should know something about Satan, and I didn't. And then I was disturbed in addition because, as I mentioned before, going to the local Christian bookstores to see what evangelicals are saying about the New Age, I find books on Satanism on the same shelf. So one day I got out my Visa and I just took them all home with me and read a dozen of them, and they were just really trash. Thinking of the first hour where I said, you know, self-justification consists of drawing a line between good and evil and putting yourself on the good side and your enemies on the bad side, these books about Satanism simply listed all of the moral decay in society that whatever the author was opposed to and consigned them all to Satanism, New Age included, and it just struck me this is not careful research. This is nothing more than a diatribe. So I needed to do some direct research to find out what's going on. I had one of my graduate students got interested and we started poking through. So now I want to tell you what I think is the case regarding the current situation as of this year in our country in particular with regard to Satanism as a phenomenon, without saying anything about Satan himself. I cut the pie this way. I think there are three groups of people that we have to deal with: the Satanists, the anti-Satanists, and the anti-anti-Satanists. And all of them constitute the phenomenon of Satanism. And when I'm doing phenomenology here, and what you do when you do phenomenology is you take a look at what people see, but you take a look at the act of seeing what's going on. And it's hard to get at the Satanists without looking at the way the anti-Satanists look at them, or the anti-anti-Satanists look at them. So there are these various layers that we have to pick through. What we don't have the option to do, in most cases, is to walk up to a Satanist and say, tell me about yourself. There are some instances in which you can do that, but not entirely. So with that caveat, as you can see from the outline here, I say there are, the word Satanism refers to four different things. First is classic cult Satanism. And this would be the kind that I described a couple of minutes ago in the case of Jenny in the book Suffer the Child. It may apply to Jamie. It's just not clear. The only symbol there was love, remember? But classical cult Satanism is the one where the ritual, of course, is the Lord's Supper, the eating of body and blood. But all of the symbols are reversed. Instead of Jesus Christ being Lord, the devil is Lord. The Lord's Prayer is said backwards. The biblical symbols are manipulated and all taken very, very literally. Historically, we can date classic cult Satanism back only as far as King Louis XIV in France. There are some hints that maybe it existed prior to that. In the Middle Ages, I do not think there was classic cult Satanism. There was witchcraft, of course, but witchcraft probably belonged to nature religion of sort of the classical sense. But a deliberate mockery or blaspheming of Jesus Christ is first documented in France, headed by a woman named Madame Lavoisin, V-O-I-S-I-N. And the situation seems to be this, that the king had a number of concubines in the court, and these concubines live a kind of contingent life. As long as the king holds them in favor, they have luxury and they have power and influence. If they fall out of favor with the king, they're usually plunged back to poverty and ignominy from which they came. And so any kind of help you can get for staying in the court would be desirable. And Madame Lavoisin seems to have been one of the disgruntled concubines. And she sought some kind of supernatural power. And I really think I think in the long run, the desire for power through magic is really what drives people in the direction of the black arts. And so Madame Lavoisin, she gathered around a group of worshipers who, in the classic sense, are willing to sell their souls to the devil. She's the first one, as far as we know, to get a defrocked Roman Catholic priest to perform the black mass. The sacrifice of babies and the eating of their flesh occurred, and probably by the height of the cult's activities, they had about 100 members, all of whom were aiming through the use of black magic to maintain power and influence in the king's court. The king discovered what was going on and put an end to it. It does not appear that there is a tradition of Satanism that's passed down from generation to generation. There are lots of unknowns in this period. As I go to church historians and ask them what happened, they don't study this stuff. And it's possible that there was a lot going on that we don't know, and if some of you would like to go to the university and write a PhD dissertation on this, the field is wide open. As we as we turn to the 20th century, I want to move from number one to number two now, public Satanism. Well, let me just say with regard to number one, it would appear that classic cult Satanism does exist in our society in secret. The tremendous debate right now is, first of all, does it exist? Secondly, if it does exist, to what extent? My own suspicion is that it does exist, but probably on a small scale, and probably not in any kind of large conspiratorial organization. I can't prove that, but when you're dealing with alleged secret groups, you have to go on your best hunches. Secondly, public Satanism. This is the kind of Satanism you can find in the yellow pages of the telephone book. It's legal. It's protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And probably the most famous of the public satanic groups is the Church of Satan in San Francisco, One More Reason to Hate California. Begun by Anton LaVey in 1966, which he claimed to be the dawn of the age of Satan. Anton LaVey follows loosely the doctrines of a predecessor named Aleister Crowley, an Englishman, who tried to use the symbolism from the book of Revelation to say that the age of Satan would begin with the coming of a satanic Messiah, the inverse of Jesus Christ as being the incarnation of God. Now a baby would be born, and this baby would be the incarnation of Satan, and you've got all of the Christian eschatology turned around now in favor of the victory of Satan. Now just make a mental note now of that doctrine of Aleister Crowley, picked up by Anton LaVey in the Church of Satan, who says now that the age of Satan has begun. LaVey's Church of Satan is a very hedonistic group. Anton LaVey's philosophy, which is published in a book called The Satanic Bible, argues that your and my natural proclivities are in the direction of sex and power. And if we get sex and power, we get happiness. And the real enemy to the human race is the Christian church, because the Christian church teaches morality. And morality gets in the way of the unbridled pursuit of happiness. So what we should do is worship Satan and not worship Christ. Now, of the things that give us pleasure, one of the ones that gives us the greatest amount of pleasure is revenge. If somebody does you wrong, you want to get them back. And if you're a Christian, unfortunately, you've got Jesus saying, love your enemies. So it's better to be a Satanist and really get the SOB. As a Yellow Pages satanic group, you cannot violate the law. So what Anton LaVey's Church of Satan offers are magical rituals whereby you can use supernatural powers to destroy your enemies. And the police cannot arrest you for using supernatural means, only natural means. So cursing plays a big role, ritual cursing. That's public Satanism. Now, it's interesting that one of Anton LaVey's disciples, a guy by the name of Michael Aquino, has a PhD in history, so any of you who thought you could cure society's ills through education better think again. Michael Aquino, by the way, he's also a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Michael Aquino has broken away from the Church of Satan and started his own group called the Temple of Set, named after the Egyptian god Set, in which he wants really a declaration of independence. He wants a Satanism that's not dependent upon the reverse of Christianity. So he argues the Egyptian god Set is really the origin of Satanism. He wants a pure Satanism. And he argues that Anton LaVey doesn't believe deeply enough in Satan, and that he, Michael Aquino, believes more. Now, let me just drop into a footnote for a minute. These are the kinds of footnotes theologians love. St. Augustine presented an interesting argument about the relationship between good and evil. Good and evil, he says, are not equal. Good is always primary. Evil is always a leech off the good. It is possible, said Augustine, to have something that is purely good. It is never possible to have something that is purely evil, because everything that is evil is a prostitution of good. That's the logic of the relationship between good and evil. So let's get back now to Michael Aquino and Anton LaVey. Michael Aquino argues that the justification for a schism in the Church of Satan is that Anton LaVey is a hypocrite. Mm-hmm. One Satanist calling another Satanist a hypocrite. So you cannot, even in the rhetoric of pure evil — there is no such thing as a rhetoric of pure evil — even in the rhetoric of evil, you must appeal to the good, namely the proposition that hypocrisy is bad and truth is good, in order to criticize somebody else. A third form of Satanism, and this is the one that we're most likely to confront, is the lone teenage dabbler. And my experience here, or at least my introduction to this, came from one of my students who was a mental health worker who specialized in teen suicide. And over the years, she said she and her colleagues had gained enough experience that there are certain patterns of teenagers who are susceptible to suicide, by far and away more boys than girls. And these potentially suicidal teen boys are also the ones that dabble in Satanism. It goes something like this. They feel estranged from their parents, for one reason or another, estranged at school. They have a tendency towards being loners in general, and they're angry about all of this. Then they start listening to heavy metal rock music, frequently by themselves with the earphones, and it doesn't appear that the heavy metal rock music itself is satanic. I don't buy that theory. But it all contributes to a downward spiral in the direction of depression. And as you know, many of these groups have capitalized upon the satanic imagery. And the kids then read the information on the albums. They start writing letters away to addresses that are given. They move from one thing to another until the Satanic Bible comes in the mail. And these kids read the Satanic Bible. They take it with far more seriousness than its author, Anton LaVey, did, who has lots of do-it-yourself rituals in there. And the torture and mutilation of animals may begin, church desecrations. In Sacramento, one of my former students had one last fall where somebody saw some lights on in his church in the middle of the night and called the police. The police came over and caught a 15 or 16-year-old boy. They turned the cross upside down. They painted pentagrams on drapes and devil signs here and there. $10,000 worth of damage. The lone teenage dabbler may have a small group of two or three friends, maybe five or six, that will engage in this kind of thing. And the incitement towards revenge may eventually lead to the murder then of either a school teacher or one or both of the parents, or suicide. In other words, the pressure is towards death in one fashion or another, but the real driving force, note, is really depression. That's what's really driving it. But the availability of the evil symbols just simply exacerbates what is already a dangerous situation. My students said that they would hold dances and they'd watch all the kids come, and they could profile them, they could watch them and designate them, and then go and try to establish a relationship with them and monitor what's going on. Now, almost all of the lone teenage dabblers grow out of it. Some don't. If they don't, then they become number four there, the serial killer. Not all serial killers are Satanists, but enough of them are. for us to know something about it. You may have seen Richard Ramirez holding up a 666 tattooed on the palm of his hand, and in news newspapers and things of that particular nature. Also, getting back to St. Augustine on good and evil, I heard, Richard Ramirez is the Night Stalker, right? He's been convicted of 13 murders. He's now being tried for, or at least the evidence has been gathered for a 14th prosecution. And he was interviewed on television a couple of months ago, and talk about self-justification. He says, what's the matter with killing 13 people? Well, you know, President Bush went over to the Middle East and killed 100,000. He says, I'm not nearly as bad as President Bush. So self-justification gets even into, and scapegoating into radical evil. Well, is there any connection between these? One of the interesting little puzzles that my research assistant and I came up with is the following. If you go back into the late 1960s, in San Francisco, it was hippie time in San Francisco, you've got the Church of Satan active. You also got, actually, in 1965, another group, less well-known, called the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which is an offshoot of Scientology. And the Process Church of the Final Judgment worked very hard, and we're talking about blasphemy now, at taking moral symbols and religious symbols and setting them side by side with their opposite, so that the Ten Commandments reads, number five is, thou shalt kill, thou shalt not kill. We can date, as of 1969, that Charles Manson was associated with the Process Church of the Final Judgment. He wrote articles for their magazine. That's pretty good evidence. That he was. Another question is, did he have a relationship with Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan down the street? We don't know for sure. But we want to ask the question this way. I think it was 1967 or 68, there was a rather widely seen movie called Rosemary's Baby. How many saw Rosemary's Baby? And if you may remember, the theme of that came from Aleister Crowley. This is Rosemary now, Rose plus Mary. Rose is the symbol of Christ. Mary, the Virgin Mother of our Lord, has sexual intercourse with the devil in order to produce the incarnation of the devil. Does anybody know who played the devil that inseminated Rosemary in the movie? The actor's name. Anton LaVey, the high priest of the Church of Satan. All right, he played that role in that movie. Does anybody know who the director of that movie was? Anybody? His name was Roman Polanski. Ever heard of Roman Polanski? Roman Polanski was the husband of who?
Sharon Tate.
And Sharon Tate was the victim of Charles Manson's ritual murder.
Pregnant.
And she was pregnant at the time. And it just seems to me that there's a circle there of influence that that needs to be closed eventually. One more phenomenon I haven't mentioned having to do with Satanism I'll get back to. But let me turn to the anti-Satanists, and I realize that here it is 7:25 already. And I'll go a little bit more quickly. Who are the anti-Satanists? If these are the Satanists, who are the anti-Satanists? Well, this is a motley crew, and it's important to note that it's a motley crew. You got television journalists such as Geraldo and Oprah Winfrey, who clearly want to sell advertising, and so they put these people on their TV sets who are either Satanist practicers or victims of satanic ritual with lurid details and turning to commercials. Then you've got crusaders such as Karl Raschke and his book Painted Black, which is a book that I recommend even though it's been sharply criticized, in which he tries to identify a large number of phenomena in our society that can be called satanic in character. It is clearly an alarmist book. But he's a professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Denver, I think, or Fort. The University of Colorado is at Boulder. Well, at any rate, I don't know what school he's from. But I found in general his scholarship to be good, solid stuff. I like this book, but it's a very controversial one. Now, let me skip the MPD people. Let me come back to them because that's more complicated. Cult cops. No, I got to do MPD first. How can I do this? Okay, multiple personality disorder. This is a person who, like Three Faces of Eve in the movie, has three different personalities, goes to the therapist. The therapist discovers multiple personalities side by side, and in the process of piecing through one personality after another, finds an original personality who suffered ritual abuse, either kidnapped by a satanic group and suffered great pain, or in the case of Jenny in the book, suffered the child, grows up, her mother was a Satanist, grows up in the cult. And these physical things, such as in the case of little Jenny, her body is cut and her skin is eaten, her blood is siphoned off for drinking, create tremendous pain, both psychological, psychic pain, as well as physical pain. The theory is, now I must say this is a phenomenon, so we've got to go through the theory, because you can't get to the event unless you go through the interpretation of the event of the therapist. The therapists get together, and the theory is this, that the trauma of the ritual abuse is so great that the personality cracks or fragments, and another personality emerges and represses or forgets the trauma. Once the personality is broken once, it can go on again and again. Jamie, whom I talked to you about a little while ago, had eight personalities before psychotherapy. Jenny in the book Suffer the Child has 400. Eve, if you may remember from that story, had three, and eventually after all things were said and done, she ended up with a fourth. So once the personality starts to fragment, it goes and goes. Now, in 1980, a book was published called Michelle Remembers by a woman named Michelle and her psychiatrist, Lawrence Pazder, who report that she had undergone ritual abuse by a satanic group on Vancouver Island in the 1950s. Now, this book is published in 1980. Nobody pays any attention to it. Oh, I'm sorry. A few people pay attention to it. 1985 comes along, and the book is republished in paperback, and Pazder and Michelle go on a book promotion tour up and down the West Coast. Sandy Gallant hears them interviewed on television. Sandy Gallant is a detective for the San Francisco Police Department whose responsibility is missing children. She says, I wonder if there could be a connection. So she interviews Pazder and Michelle, and she says maybe missing children are kidnapped by satanic groups. So she gets down with a typewriter, asks some secretaries to go out and get some information on satanic groups. She types up a few sheets of paper with a list of symbols, satanic symbols, and has it Xeroxed and sent around. I learned yesterday, you don't Xerox anything. You copy things on the Xerox machine. And sends these copies around and asks detectives, when you come upon a crime and you find these symbols, tell me. I want to come in and be part of the investigation, see if it has to do with missing children. Well, this is good stuff. One policeman passes it to another, send it to their friends in other police departments. Pretty soon the Los Angeles Police Department is spreading it around. The Baldwin Park Police Department sees the thing, they rip off Sandy Gallant's cover, they put on their own, describe it the symbolism of the stoners, the gang of the stoners. It spreads from police department to police department all around the country, and now they've all got Sandy Gallant's manual. So then now they start having conventions, and police departments start assigning one or another officer to cult crime, and eventually now we have a whole profession of specialists in cult crime around the country. In the meantime, Sandy Gallant has become a little bit more sophisticated. She still believes that this is important stuff, but the connection on any large scale between missing children and satanic groups has not yet been established. Parents of children in daycare centers. You probably have all heard about the most expensive court trial in the history of this country, the McMartin preschool trial in Southern California. There are 100 such cases, either having finished or pending in this country right now, where the parents of children in preschools, day schools, are supporting prosecution of the people who run the day schools under the accusation that they are engaging in ritual abuse of the children. The phrase ritual abuse was invented by the agnostic and secular social workers and attorneys in 1985 who were involved in the McMartin preschool because they thought the word satanic had religious overtones and they wanted to keep the court trial as non-religious as they possibly could. So the word ritual abuse is a secular code word for satanic cults, or at least it was originally. It's probably gone beyond that. Now, in no case yet has any of these day school people been convicted of satanic abuse. In one case, Jordan, Minnesota, one of the defendants, I think it was one out of 24, if I'm not mistaken, a man as an individual was convicted of pedophilia. But the group were not convicted of satanic abuse. Finally, evangelical and fundamentalist preachers, those are the ones that write the books and put the tapes in the Christian bookstores that I was telling you about before. That group comprises the anti-Satanists, and there's another component in there in which some of these people are involved. These are people who are anti-cults in general, are also anti-Satanists. Now, who are the anti-anti-Satanists? Well, they're the people I hang around with. They're the university types, the social scientists who study new religious movements, who believe there is no such thing as Satan, there is no such thing as Satanism, and they believe that the real criminals in this case are the anti-Satanists who are creating a great deal of falderal and are basically trying to blame Satanists, the non-existent Satanists, for the ills of our society. There are also some anti-cult cops. They're few in number, but they are disgusted with the shenanigans of the cult cops, so they've kind of rebelled against them. Most importantly are the skeptics. The group that calls themselves by various names, atheists, secular humanists, naturalists, and they have a club. It's called the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. It's centered in Buffalo, New York, and they have one of the best magazines out called the Skeptical Inquirer. If you're of that mind, it's one of the most exciting magazines to read. I cannot agree with their philosophy, but they have good articles. They use their so-called scientific skills to disprove all forms of paranormal activity. They're anti-New Age, they're anti-astrology, they're anti-UFOs, they're anti-Satanists, and they're opposed to Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and any other kind of religion as well. Now, this was a puzzling mystery for me. Why is it that things break down this way? Why would you have anti-Satanists at all? And as I looked carefully and I talked with them and I read their articles, it goes like this. The anti-Satanists have a position. They are atheists and agnostics and secular humanists. And they interpret the anti-Satanists as to be all evangelical Christians who believe, here's the logic now, who believe that if they can convince America that Satan exists, then it'll be a small step to convince America that God exists. So the real, the argument of the anti-Satanists is that the anti-Satanists have created Satanism. See the argument? Satanism does not exist. It's the fabrication of the anti-Satanists who are evangelical Christians who are trying to pull a hoax off on the American public in violation of the First Amendment, and the anti-Satanists are going to protect the First Amendment. One of the problems in the argument is if you just take a look at this list, this isn't all evangelical Christians. If you look at the parents of the children in the daycare centers, for example, only some of them are evangelical Christians. Many of them are Jews, secular people, other religious traditions. That cannot be an evangelical Christian conspiracy. Among the cult cops, and I've asked a number of them, I said, are all of your colleagues Christians? No, there's lots of Jews and secularists amongst them. So you got conspiracy theory on top of conspiracy theory. I've really got to quit talking. What I've basically done is something like going to the ballpark and having somebody sell you a program so you get the players and what their numbers are. And that's basically what I've tried to do tonight, to give you a roadmap. Things are going to be changing over the next couple of years. Please watch for these players. And I've got a lot more to say, but I think I'd better let you interject here with questions or comments or what have you. Yes?
Before you run away from the whole thing, I'd like to hear the theological point you have down there.
My theological point is this. You know that Satan is present when you hear the call to shed innocent blood. I don't have a lot to say about Satan, but when I think about a core to evil, the shedding of innocent blood comes to mind for a number of reasons. Clearly, in the case of ritual abuse that I just discussed, that's the heart of it. The literal, physical slaying of an innocent person in order to, think back to Ernest Becker, clearly when these men that Jamie saw eating the heart of that slain girl were getting her life power. I did not tell you the Matamoros story, which is clearly documented. We got photographs and everything in the Matamoros case. De Constanzo, who was the high priest of the Matamoros cult, sold limpias, what he called cleansings, and they would take prostitutes and pimps and drug addicts from the Zona Rosa in Mexico City, lay them out, terrorize them so that in the moment of abject fear, kill them, and then eat the heart deliberately in order to get the power of that soul for their own use. And so that's not imagination, it's not fiction, that's all documented with witnesses, etc. All right, so that's the most literal form of stealing somebody else's blood for my own empowerment. What's the most shallow form? The water cooler syndrome. My security guards at Carson Perry Scott saying that Mr. Martinson is about to lose his job because he's incompetent. That's a psychological form of stealing Mr. Martinson's blood, you know, figuratively speaking, in order to empower me. When you and I engage in scapegoating and self-justification, at root we want to steal someone else's power in order to relieve the problem of anxiety that we're suffering. Then you turn with this structure of sin to the crucifixion and death of Jesus, and ask, what are we talking about when we say Jesus died for our sins? And all of those structures come to the fore. Pontius Pilate, remember Pontius Pilate and King Herod made a deal. They were enemies, right? But they finally decided that if Jesus should die, they could be friends again. That's what the Gospel of Luke says. They are friends. They work out peace in the land. They get political power from the death of Jesus. And, I mean, the whole message, divine, God's message to us is this ain't the way it works in God's scheme. What launched me on this was M. Scott, the final chapters of M. Scott Peck's book, People of the Lie, which a lot of people don't like, having to do with suicide. And people who are about to commit suicide hear a voice. Kill yourself. kill yourself. A great story in a book by, never mind, I'll leave that. That's a form of slaying the innocent, shedding innocent blood, I think. And in the case of M. Scott Peck, he wanted to talk about demonic voices in that case. And at any rate, so that's how I arrived at that that little line. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
What do you know about demon possession?
I haven't gotten that far yet, and I'm stopping short of that. I mean, let me tell you, I've interviewed a number of people on it, and my most exciting interview took place in Sri Lanka last fall with an Anglican priest who had practiced exorcism throughout his career as a priest. Boy, this can be another. I'll try to keep this one short. And one of the questions I had was whether it's a difference between a Christian and a non-Christian. Because Sri Lanka, there are only a few Christians there. Most people are Buddhist, and then there are a few Hindus and Muslims. But almost everybody is a Buddhist. And he said the phenomenon is the same, whether you're Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, or Hindu, in terms of the symptoms of demon possession. And his liturgy is the same as well. And I won't go into all the details, but the climax, of course, is his command in the name of Jesus Christ for the demon to leave the possessed individual. It doesn't matter. Same command, whether it's a Hindu, a Buddhist, or a Muslim. And it works. And the whole family is present. And so then I asked, I said, okay, so it works. So now, what happens afterward if it's a Buddhist family? Do they get interested in Christianity? He says, sometimes. He says, most of the time they thank me and they just leave. I never see them again. Although at the Lanka Theological College, where I was lecturing at the time, there were two students there who had formerly been Buddhists who had been exorcised and were now Christians. But this is random stuff. I don't really have a theory about what's going on. And note that I've tried to handle both sin and Satanism without trying to get into the question of demon possession. So. Yes, sir.
Yeah. As an element in our society, how pervasive do you think these groups are? In your studies, what have you seen?
Well, with regard to number one, classic cult Satanism, my hunch is very small, very rare, but yes, it does exist. I do not think it would be wise for us to think that every time a child turns up missing, that child's been kidnapped by one of these groups. I mean, it may be true, but the evidence isn't there, so I would say small. Certainly, the public Satanism has a very tiny influence. The people over whom they have an influence, clearly their lives are damaged severely. But the Church of Satan, I think, only has 2,000 members, maybe, worldwide, and it is now collapsing. Mrs. LeVay is divorcing Mr. LeVay, and I understand that the Bed of Nails is up for auction. The Temple of Set is still thriving, but it's a good deal more sophisticated, but also small. The lone teenage dabbler is by far and away the largest phenomenon, but as I'm suggesting, it's tied to a more general problem of teenage life that afflicts a large number, especially of boys who are going through the terrible teens, and that we would have the problem of teenage depression without the satanic symbolism. The satanic symbolism only exacerbates it. Then finally, the serial killer. Again, that's a very small number of people, but obviously, if you're near them, you don't want to be. You don't want to be there. So I do not approve of the kind of alarmist literature that you quite frequently see, that the whole nation is getting overrun by satanic forces. I don't think that's reasonable. Yes, sir.
We hear stories of suicide packs amongst teenagers and this type of thing, where groups or two or three or more.
Right.
They're determined that they're all going to commit suicide. And these stories go through the school, there's supposed to be two more or something like that. Is that related to this lone teenage dabbler type of?
Yes, it is. And of course, in some cases, those stories are root true. But schools just love to get into a panic over these kinds of rumors. I mean, you should take them with sufficient seriousness to investigate, but everything that you hear is not true. That's just the case. But there are some incidents in which their suicide pacts are carried out, and so also are murders.